Blessings and good evening. Mr. Camille here with you.
Showtime, star time. Yeah, it's a www.caribbeanradioshow.com. We got it good to go. Dr. F, let them know so the girls that love it nice and mellow. Selfish show. Hey, you live the life you love. You love the life you live. Any music you want, Dr. F will give. Ooh-wee. Greetings, Dr. F brings. From Jah to all ragamuffins who rockin' and swing. Greetings, Dr. F. Bring from Jah out ya to all Caribbean lovers who wing. For all the diamonds and the money and pearls, Dr. F. will keep playing reggae around the world. No matter what the price, where music is nice, all your little string and rub it tonight. Whoa, greetings, Dr. Ebring, from Jah to all ragamuffins. Ooh-wee, greetings, Dr. Ebring, from Jah out ya to all ragamuffins. Most definitely, we got it like that. It's www.caribbeanradioshow with Dr. F. Surfing show, the girls still love it so. Keep it nice and mellow. Yeah, this is our friend representing. Pick up yourself, Dr. F. Give it to them, said Pete.
Blessings. Good evening, beautiful people. This is Sister Camille with Dr. F tonight on the air. Chilling with you, talking with you. This topic is kind of serious tonight, as it usually is. Before we jump into the meat of the matter, I want to play a little Bob Marley tune for you, Bob Marley Redemption Song, which is very fitting for the discussion that we're having tonight. So listen up and start meditating on some of the questions and some of the thoughts that's going to jump in your mind while this conversation begins, all right? And it's real serious, you know, but it's also about healing each other and loving each other. So Redemption Song, Bob Marley.
Thank you.
Song. Dr. Eve, sister, how are you?
Oh, wonderful, my dear sister. Good evening to you. And welcome, welcome to this other
good to
side
hear your
of
voice.
World.
Yes, yes, yes. It's good to hear you. It's good to hear you.
Good to hear you, too. And I know you've still been struggling with your little mail here and there, so I am so happy to hear that at least a little sense of cheerfulness in your voice.
Yes, yes, yes. Absolutely. You know, storm don't last always, right?
No, I'm telling you, girl.
Don't last always. What happens is at the end of it, you find out how strong you really are.
Absolutely.
And so I'm here seeing my strength, but I love the discussion that we're having tonight. I thought about it a lot since our last conversation. Because it's something that that I struggled with and try to clarify and understand in my own journey of not just forgiving others but myself. And I think there's a double-edged sword, sort of, in this question. But I'd love to hear from others tonight just to kind of tag back on what they think about that forgiveness and redemption and what that means for those of us that have experienced a trauma or abuse from the hands of others in our lives. 661-467-2407. So what are your thoughts on that topic? You know, do we have to forgive? Do we have to bring people? What is forgiveness to you in terms of, you know, experiencing abuse or in terms of experiencing a certain type of trauma? How do you know you've forgiven somebody? Does that mean you let them back into your life? Does that mean you cannot harbor still some kind of anger or resentment towards them? What does it really mean?
For me personally, what I know I have truly forgiven, I guess everybody has their own way of interpreting things. And for me, it has to do with that I'm a feeling person. I carry things within my body, even rather than so much in my spirit. I guess, well, it's maybe I try not to make things get to that point, because when it gets to a spiritual point, it's a whole different stage for me. When I think about forgiveness, or when I'm thinking of pain, my entire inside, somewhere, it is just heavy and weighty and burdensome. And for me, if thinking to let that go, there's a kind of a peace within me. Within me, it doesn't sometimes necessarily mean I necessarily are friends with my abuser, or an abuser could be somebody that hurts you in any kind of way, or mistreats you in any kind of way. For me, when I feel a lightness inside of me, it's like I allow myself to get the freedom from whatever the connection between the thing, because sometimes it can be a thing or that person, and I can dance around it. That's the word that comes to me. I can really dance freely around it. You think about holding somebody close to you, really laying your head and making sure that feeling of total connectivity, a word, and the freedom of just letting go and get back in. There's no, never, nothing blocking you. This is how I personally feel.
Yes.
Does that mean that I am going to invite you to dinner? Not necessarily. It just means that whatever is between both of us, I decide that is not going to block my happiness. Let's use the word happiness. Or my sense of feeling gaiety or any of those wonderful words. But it doesn't necessarily mean that I'm going to hug you, kiss up with you, share my food with you, share my space with you. Sometimes that may happen, and sometimes it is just that a signal for me, and usually really,
right.
I sometimes get that is a matter of I distance you way distance you. You almost at the point seems to exist, but within me, I have a freedom. I've let you go off that burden, and I feel light dancing on my feet. I don't know.
That makes a lot of sense. And for me, the distinction is redemption and forgiveness. Or in forgiving someone, are we responsible for their redemption? That's how the question is interpreted through my own experience and understanding. And redemption for me is a process that happens only with an individual and their divine. So yes, I can forgive my abusers. I can, not hold and harbor any pain. And you, like you said, experience that sense of freedom for me, because, when you hold on to pain, you're not hurting your abuser. You're really hurting yourself.
Mm-hmm.
When you're holding on to the unforgiveness, you're not hurting the person that hurt you, you're hurting yourself. And so for me, the idea of forgiveness is also, I have to think about redemption, what it means to be redeemed. And that process to me is not, I can't redeem you. I can forgive you, but I can't redeem you. And in forgiving you, I can make the choice in saying, I no longer hold you in a place in my heart, in my mind, and in my body, that inspires or evoke pain or guilt or shame or anything like that. What I've done is I'm releasing the pain, and with that I'm releasing my abuser. And so, but is that person then, because I forgive them, because I'm releasing them to God, to the divine, to the universe, does it mean that they then accept that and then make a 360 and turn around? Are they accepting that and repented, and then they're changing their behavior? And now we can see each other human to human and see and recognize that we are both at some level in pain. And for me, that's the question. Does that mean that my abuser has changed because I have forgiven them? Does that mean that my abuser is changing their behavior, changing their pathology, changing the way that they operate in community with others, with themselves? Because, you inflict upon others, Dr. Eve, what you are inflicted upon yourself at some psychological, emotional, physical level. And so have they gotten to the point in their own journey to start their own healing, and then to see the harm that they've done, to see the pain that they've caused? Those are the questions that are evoked inside of me when I'm talking about forgiveness and forgiving my abuser and forgiving myself. Because forgiveness is a word, but it also evokes action. It's like love. You can't say, well, I love you, but then you act in a way that is very unloving. That doesn't work. So I can't say I forgive somebody, or someone says, well, I accept the fact that you've forgiven me. I accept you, you know, and then they go back and they continue the behavior. They continue that action. And that's what's important to me. So, yes, I can forgive my I can forgive the most horrendous act, and I have. That's been perpetrated against me. It's been perpetrated against others. And I can still see that person through the lens and through the eyes of a human being, because we are all fallible, you know, human beings. We're fallible. We're not perfect. We're in the process of being perfected as we move through this journey. So, yes, we will make mistakes. But does it mean, like you said, I'm going to invite you to dinner? Does it mean that I was raped and now I've forgiven my rapist and this person happens to move in my neighborhood and I have children, I'm going to invite them into my home, be around? No. No, I'm not. That's not going to happen. So, yes, I can forgive you, and I can actually love you, because, remember, love is a verb. It's an action. It's not just words that say, well, I love you, and then I'm just going to go and act all unforgiving and hateful. No, I can love someone that has hurt me. I can do that. But will I allow that person space to come back into my life, to come back around my family, to come back into my community, without them recognizing the pain that they've caused, without them changing the direction of their behavior? Again, repentance. Have they repented? Have they turned around? Repentance is a turning around of. It's not just saying, I'm sorry. That's not repentance. Repentance means I'm sorry, and that these are the things that I'm going to do to ensure that I will not allow myself to cause harm on anyone else, that I will try my hardest to do no harm. I will become transparent in my action. I will, you know, be very intentional about how I'm moving forward. So for me, these words are powerful words, Dr. Eve, but we have to be mindful, and even in our discussion, to recognize the heaviness of these words and what they imply and what they evoke and what they mean truly. And for me, when you talk about forgiveness, it goes hand in hand with being redeemed. And that is an act of the divine. So, yes, me, the divine working in and through me will allow me to say, yes, I have forgiven you. Now the divine now comes into your life if you're open to and redeem you, and you're the one that have to accept that. The abuser, the molester, the rapist, they're the ones that's going to have to accept that. Does it mean now that we don't enact laws, that they don't need to be punished? No. Hell yeah, you going to jail. You abuse, you rape, you have to take the responsibility of your actions, kind of determined by society. And yes, if you're a rapist and you're an abuser, you're a pedophile, yes, you should go to jail. Your crime should be dealt with in a way that sends a message to the person that you hurt, but also to the community, that this will not be tolerated. So, no, it doesn't mean that because we forgive and because we love, it doesn't mean that then we are going to allow the abuser and the person that hurt us and hurt our community and hurt our children to come back into our space. We have to ask some questions about that. I was watching a show, and I think I shared this with you. I don't know if it was on air or personally, but it was a show on CNN, and it was talking to the mother and a daughter of a pedophile. The father was a pedophile. Her husband was a pedophile. And so this mother witnessed very early into her child, her baby girl's life, while she was in diapers, less than a year old, a violation of the most horrendous kind that this father, did against his daughter. He molested her. The mother took the diaper off and found blood in the diaper. The mother went to the husband and said, what have you done? The husband acknowledged, yes, I am sorry, I did it. I will never do it again. I know I'm wrong. Now, this child is not able to speak. This child is not able to express the pain or the sense of shame. This is express the burden of being treated like that by her father. So she's depending upon the mother to take some action, to do something. But the mother accepted her husband, which is the father of this child. I'm sorry. I will never do it again. And so life continued on. And the husband did it again. Some years later, again and again and again, the mother went back again and again to the husband, and he said, I'm sorry. The mother even at one point went to the local pastor and said, this is what's going on with her husband. This is what's happening. I've seen it before. He's done it before. She was little. You know, now she's, you know, maybe 10 or whatever. He's doing it again. What are we to do? And so the pastor said to this mother, who obviously have gotten to a place in her own existence that she sees, she has no power for her to allow this to happen year after year. And still she's asking permission. Remind you now, this woman who witnessed her child being raped, who witnessed her child being violated, is asking permission from a pastor, another man, what to do? What am I supposed to do? So the pastor said to this mother, don't tell anyone. Keep this in the family. Let's pray for your husband. Let's pray together. But also, as a woman, as a mother, what I want you to do is I want you to make sure you are more available to your husband. You give him what you need. You satisfy his needs. Be there for him. Now, I remind you, this woman, this mother, is going and asking for help for her child. But the pastor said, let's take care of your husband. Let's take care of this man. He's obviously needing something that you're not giving him. So this woman did that. The abuse continued until this young woman was 16 or 17, where she decided that she needed to remove herself from that situation, that dynamic. And she did that. But not only did she remove herself, and she took control of her own life at that time. She went to the authorities and filed charges against her father. That took some time for that punishment to be, you know, placed upon him. Maybe too, she was about 20 or 21. That he got found guilty and was sent to prison for 15 years. Not enough time, in my estimation. So this mother and this daughter, who's now in her 20s, you know, middle 20s, are on the show talking about this experience. And as I'm sitting there and I'm listening to this young woman with such poise and such strength and courage and boldness, I wish that her name would come back into my mind, because I wanted to lift that up tonight, because she just, to me, just was so amazing to not only got to the point in her own young life, but that's all she knew from her father was abuse, but she took it upon herself to forgive him enough to move on, to see herself good enough still, because that's part of forgiveness. It allows you to see yourself as you truly are, powerful, empowered, capable. So she was able to forgive this man, her father, enough to see herself as worthy. And she claimed her power, took it further and claimed her power and pressed charges, took it even further and testified, make sure that this crime that was committed against her before she was able to say anything to anybody about her worth or for anybody, she took that control. This man got found guilty, sent to jail for 15 years. And still she's claiming her power, because on the show she said, no, 15 years is not enough for what he's done to me. And the host asked her, so have you forgiven your mother?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was so proud of this woman. I didn't know her, but all I could do was just send positive love and energy and prayer, lifting her up and her children and her life. Because she said, yes, I forgave my mother. However, I'm still working through that.
Wow.
So forgiveness doesn't mean, you know, that her mother is in her life and there, this happy mother-to-daughter dynamic going on. She recognized this woman as broken to the point that her mother couldn't even stand up and protect her as a little girl. But what was also very powerful in that is that the mother took responsibility right there on the air. And you can still see the sense of brokenness within this mom, this woman, that allowed her baby girl, before she could even talk and move, she allowed her to be possessed, to be controlled, to be violated, abused, raped, all the way until this baby girl became a grown woman and was able to then claim her power herself. So forgiveness looks and feels very different. It's different. It's not just saying, "Oh, I forgive them and I'm going to move on and that's fine. They could, you know, I'm okay with whatever." And no, forgiveness requires some deliberate and intentional action. You have to do something with it. Like this young woman, she forgave her mother and her father, but it didn't mean that she allowed him back into her life. It didn't mean that she wasn't going to pursue charges and watch him go through the system and found guilty and serve his time. It didn't mean that she's back with her mother and having this great mother-daughter connection and relationship. No, it means that she is moving on with her life. She's recognizing that if she holds on to the unforgiveness, she probably would not have been able to stand up so strong and so firmly and take this man to court to do all she's done. So forgiveness is an action. It's a verb. We just don't say, "I forgive." And though in my family, Dr. Eve, just growing up, and it took me a long time because I allowed myself to continue to be in the same conversation with my family and with some of our abusers, and because the dynamic was so... It was before I was born, just like that young woman. You know, I didn't stand up for myself until after I was a mother, I was a wife. It's a process, but I know that as I look back through my own journey and even my siblings, that we were trained and taught that it was okay to allow these men, these grown-ass men, to be back into our space, that raped us, that violated us, that impregnated some of us, where we had miscarriages. They were still, they were there at cookouts and dinners. And as little girls, we thought when we left Jamaica, when we left that space, we thought, "God, thank you, finally free, at least from seeing and being around this abusive environment." But hell no. There was more in store for us. These abusers not just lived next door like they did in Jamaica. They were actually living in our house. So forgiveness is not something you do just by saying, "I forgive." It is something you have to live into. You have to work through. But once you are able to get to that place, Dr. Eve, you are able to say, "Yes, I can forgive my abuser, but I will never forget, and I will never forget for this reason. I will never allow it to happen again to me or to any other children or to any other woman." So we're not holding on to the memory of the pain simply because it feels good. You know, the worst thing someone could say to someone that's been abused, at least from my perspective, is why are you still thinking about it? Do you know what that feels like when someone have the audacity, after you've shared your story, after you've opened yourself up, to come and say to you, "Why are you still thinking about it?"
Mm-hmm.
What? How do you not stop thinking about being raped? It's not that you think about it. It's the fact of what you use the memory to do. So just recognize forgiveness is more than just saying, "Oh, I forgive them. I'm okay. I'm moving on with my life. I'm happy now. I have a husband, and I have a partner. I have a friend. I have children. I have a good career. I'm successful. It's more than that. It's more than that.
Do you think there's a lot of instances where young girls have to almost literally beg and preach and yell and scream, especially in instances where the mother of this child takes on a boyfriend or another man in the house, which is not the father, because quite a bit of abuses are done by the male counterpart or the male friend of their mom.
Mm.
And a lot of times these mothers continually to further abuse these kids, verbal abusing these kids when they come to make a report that, hey, mom, you know, your man is whatever he's doing that is inappropriate. And the mom would say stuff like, oh, you don't want me to be happy. You're a liar. This never happened. Why are you doing this to me? Why would you say something like this? What is going on in that mom's life? And this is no judgment here because, I see where if you're a young mom and not understanding what life is, your body is in need of things, the love, the attention and all of that. So sometimes the child becomes secondary, unfortunately. This is just the facts of life.
Yeah.
What is it that we need so much from our partners that we would negate our child's need and what they're saying for a partner? I mean, what is happening here? Why this continually happens?
Mm. That's a great question. I would love somebody to call in and add to that as well. But I could only speak from my own experience and from what I experienced and what I saw, what I witnessed, being a part of the church, having some of these conversations, counseling people in this dynamic. There are things that we are brought up to believe, you know, about ourselves, about women, about men, about children. There are things that we have been trained, we've been taught. And it's environmental, it's sometimes it's cultural, that we, if we step away and try to challenge that or try to do something, you know, that would go against that, it would cause a lot of conflict, not just within a church, but within a community, within a house, within just, and that's not what we want to do. We don't want to deal with that. We don't want to have to deal with, on just a general basis, it's very difficult for people generally, whether it's in the church or whether it's in a family, to stand up and challenge some, you know, ideologies that are just wrong in the sense that it causes harm to children, it causes harm to women, it causes harm to others. And so this woman, you know, I'm thinking about this mother that allowed, you know, she saw blood in her baby's diaper. Like, that's a hard thing to, like, move through. As a woman, as a mom, having children, knowing the anxiety that I felt as a mother when I was pregnant with my first child, I kid you not, I was having these insane flashbacks about my own abuse and worrying, knowing I had a baby girl in my womb, knowing that what if I was not able to protect her? What if I allowed the same thing to happen? What if something was so deficient in me that I was going to allow that to happen to my child? What if I'm not strong enough? What if because I was abused, I'm going to be an abuser? And all these things just running around in my head as a mom. Now, I don't know what it was for that mother or other mothers, but I know for me what kept me dogged in pursuing a sense of being healthy and reading and researching and talking to people and going to counseling and, I mean, just whatever I could find to make sure that I was okay so that I would never allow that to happen to my child. I did that. I confronted my abusers, you know, at least as best as I could. I tried to talk to my family. I did whatever I felt like I needed to do.
Tell me something, Sister Camille. How did you, here is a young girl being abused, I would think, by a family member or somebody that was known to the family. How do you approach this? Because were you thinking at any point in time, what were you thinking when this was done to you? And first of all, and then how do you get the courage? Was it, how were you feeling? Were you feeling angry in that you brought this out with your abuse?
I was not feeling angry, and I thank you so much for asking that question. Again, for me personally, I knew, maybe it was instinct, it was intuition. I knew that life was not what this experience was showing me. I don't know why, Dr. Eve. I honestly don't know. But I knew early on that life was bigger than the environment and the experiences that I was having. And so because I had that as a way of thinking, I was very intentional early on to seek out help for myself because I wanted to meet life. Meaning I felt like life was like up here, way up into this mountaintop, and I was like down in the valley. And so I was constantly trying to climb these walls, these steps to get up. I was like, I know life is up there, and I've got to get up there. And so for me, part of that healing and the way I thought about it, I needed to talk to my abuser simply because I needed to understand why. I wanted, at some level, I wanted to just confront that for myself. No one was telling me I needed to do it. No one said I should do it. I just did it because I wanted to be healed. I didn't want to have hatred. I wanted to just feel free enough to enjoy life. That's what I wanted. I kept telling myself as a little girl and as a young woman, I wanted to know what life was like without this sense of shame and worthlessness and burden and baggage.
So when this abuse happened, how did you feel after this abuse happened and up to the point that you decide to confront the abuse?
How did you feel? When it happened, I felt dirty. I felt shameful. I felt nasty, and I'm going to get a little graphic because this is how it happened. And for the longest time, it was not until last year that I was able to at least talk about one of the incidences of my abuse. I was molested by two cousins, and a part of my struggle has been, and at times it still is remembering, is holding on to the age and remembering exactly when it happened, and because there was such a vulnerability on my part. But the abuse, my cousins used to perform oral sex on me all the time. And I didn't, as a little girl, I just couldn't understand why. They were twice my size. I'm 5'1" now. I'm 42 years old. I'm barely 120 pounds if that, fully wet. You know, so I've always been a very small, petite child, person. But I was developed, and so for whatever reason, for whatever thing that was going on in their head, that's what they pursued from me, both of them, and eventually it led up to them wanting to have actual intercourse. And I couldn't, at the time it was happening, I blanked out. I didn't hold on to that. All I remember was after it happened, and I remember a smell that would, even to today, when I come across a smell that reminded me of this smell, it would take me back into that space of my abuse. And the smell, what I found out, was their breath after they've had oral sex with me. And it traumatized me to the point where I intentionally forgot. Like, I just dropped it out of my head because I couldn't hold the two pieces together. Being a child, these were my cousins, and what was this thing that, because remember, I didn't know what this was. I didn't know what was going on. There was no reference for me. I didn't know anything about sex. I didn't know anything about my own body. I didn't know anything about anything. So I couldn't fit the pieces together for the longest time. But after my cousins molested me at about 13, possibly 14, I was raped violently in my parents' home. And that incident, I held on to from that incident was, after it happened, I can remember sitting on our steps leading up to our kitchen, and my rapist was there, and I was numb, and I saw my underwear that was ripped up, you know, sitting there at the bottom of the steps. And all I kept thinking was, what am I going to tell my mother about my underwear? I kept repeating that, and I guess to the point where I said it out loud, and my rapist came over and said, "Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. I'll buy you some underwear."
Oh, God.
I just kept hearing, you know, myself. I disconnected from the whole experience because he ripped my clothes off. He ripped everything off, and he just did that. And I just can remember me saying, "What am I going to tell my mother about my underwear?" Because I allowed this person into the house. I don't know what I was thinking. Maybe we're going to watch television. I don't even know what was going in my head, but what I remembered was this person knocking on the door. Then I remembered I was sitting on the steps looking at what happened to my underwear. So for me, the incidents themselves were very painful because I was alone. I was left. I didn't know anything. I was by myself, and I was vulnerable. I was a little girl. I didn't have anyone to care for me and take care of me and protect me. And so, but what made it even much more difficult for me was the dynamic in my environment in which I lived, because I couldn't talk about it. I totally went inside as a little girl. I became quiet. I just shut down, and I developed this.
And then at that point, and this is another thing, Lord, then at that point, you know, being in Jamaica, we're not probably at the time, Mom was not aware of all of the things, why her feisty little girl all of a sudden shut down and start to close out. And did she ever ask, you know, or that particular how did you respond to her?
No, my mother, to be honest with you, this is a first, because I've never shared the rape with my family. It was not until I was pregnant with my first child that I was able to even tell my parents about the molestation. And for me, in my family, I played a particular role, and I still do, and I'm okay with that. I love my family. But my role in my family was one to be, you know, once I got older, my family, just depending upon my wisdom, you know, there was just things about me that they needed me to be a particular way and to be strong and to be, so I didn't want to carry, I didn't want to place that burden on them, because for the longest time they held me in a place of the one that was protected. Remember, both my siblings were raped, okay? And my boy siblings were abused, so physically abused. So we come from this place where violence was enacted upon us as children. And so for the longest time, my family believed and thought that I was protected. Why, I don't know, because no one was here to protect me. So It was very interesting. So for the longest time, I wanted to give them that. I just couldn't. There was so much craziness going on in the home and around me that I didn't want to add anything else. Because, you know, I was a home alone a lot. So whenever family was together, you know, we didn't have a lot of time together as family. So I didn't want to somehow, you know, I just remember being told, Camille, you know, as long as you're okay, the family's going to be okay. As long as you're good. You know, there was just a dependence upon me as a thermometer or something for the family that, I, at that time, as a little girl, as a child growing up, as a young woman, I didn't want to. And then I saw the dynamic, the relationship with, you know, my siblings and my mom and my parents, and just I didn't want to be a part of that craziness. I didn't want to add to that. And so I tried to take care of myself, you know, because there was no one there. And it was not until I got to be 21 where I decided I was going to share with my mom and my dad. And I remember the day very clearly. I was pregnant. I must have been 6 or 7 months pregnant, and we lived in North Carolina, and I went up to New York, and I in the kitchen, and it was heavy on my heart because I was having these flashbacks, you know. And I went to my mom, and I said, and my dad, they were both in the kitchen, and I said, I needed to tell you something. I need to share something with you. And so I shared with them, you know, that these cousins molested me, and I don't know what I expected them to say or do. I really don't. I just knew I needed to release it. And their response, let's just say, you know, they come from a different generation. And so from that response, I just decided upon myself that I needed to not share anything else. I needed to just kind of move through my own journey the best way I knew how. But not to put any, you know, responsibility or blame. It's just of when you recognize something is not going to be helpful towards you healing and getting better, I decided that I didn't want to engage that conversation any deeper, any further with my family. And so that journey has been, that was when I was 21. So 21 years ago, I decided I was just going to finish this journey on my own because I went through the molestation and the rape alone. I experienced loneliness, and so I decided to keep moving and build myself up, be prayerful, be connected to my own children, to my husband, to my family, to my community, and that's what I did. It's not easy. What I've learned since then is that there are resources and communities out there that you can reach out to and that can help you, but it was just a very difficult thing. I felt very worthless, Dr. E, very dirty. I felt bad about myself. You know,
do you think that feeling all of a sudden makes you you're instantly honing something that you may have enticed, you may have caused, or is there an instant fear? Why young girls have been for their lifetime that stuff away all of these hurts and pain and see their abusers standing strong and laughing in your family's face and to the point that they can come around and do it once, twice, and repeatedly so, and nothing is done about them. Do they think that, or do they know that you will never ever speak about this? This is why this continued to happen, because there is no love or affection in this kind of a molestation. Is there any kind of that these people ever feel connected to the abuse?
You know, I. All I know is that the experience I had was I came from, these are not weak women, but I came from women who experienced themselves some level of abuse and who also grew up in a different time, a different era in Jamaica. And so maybe a part of the message that they received was that, you know, it was okay. You know, I don't know. And so therefore, they then felt like there was this, there's nothing that they could have done. There's nothing that they should do because it's just, I don't know. That's a question that I still wrestle with in all honesty. I just, as a little girl, and a lot of the way that the anger that sometimes still gets bubbled up in me when I hear about incidents like, you know, that, or I hear just this kind of injustice that are perpetrated against little girls and women, it's because I don't understand. As a little kid, this is the interpretation that I had. As a woman now, I see that there's options, but as a little kid, and that's the thing that we have to remember, you know, post-traumatic stress is not just a military diagnosis. It's a post-traumatic stress is stress that happens on a child's life and a person's life that causes so much trauma, so much. It's an emotional scarring that is so deep that it relives itself in a person's life over and over again because of certain things that are maybe happening, going on, certain people will trigger it. And so, I don't know, maybe these women were suffering from some level of post-traumatic stress. I don't know. I can't decide or figure out what that's about. Mm-hmm. I cannot
Do
figure out what that's about.
That because this is continuing to happen to little girls all over. We just read it. We have on our Facebook page why help the woman cry. A 2 8-month-old baby was just raped week or so ago, and really torn up. And there were people that was present while this was going on.
Yes.
I mean, what is it? That would, I mean, I'm asking you a question. I don't necessarily expecting an answer. This is the father of this 8-month-old baby who raped the baby and tore her up, right? I mean, what would it be in somebody's psyche to even think in this?
And that's not some things that there's something, to be honest, are you're right, there's psychological issues going on. The problem for me becomes it's those bystanders, just like the bystanders in my family, just like the bystanders in million other little kids, you know, little girls' families, just like the bystanders of, I mean, it's the people who are witnessing, who are aware, who have some sort of inclination, who have some sense of some shit ain't right. You know, something isn't right. But still yet they choose, because again of these environmental and cultural or religious ideologies, you know, they choose not to do anything. And that, for me, is the issue. Because we are, society will have, continually have people who are, you know, deviant in the way they think, in the way they think about women and girls. That's not going anywhere. But the problem becomes, Dr. Eve, and this has been my experience, this is the experience that I've witnessed within the church, this is the experience that I've witnessed in countless other conversations, not just in the Caribbean community, not just in the African-American community. I'm talking about my Korean sisters. I'm talking about my Caucasian sisters. I'm talking about women in Israel, in Palestine. I am talking about communities all over the world that have this sense of ownership towards women, where we and girls, where it's this group think, this group mentality gets into play because of cultural, because of religious, because of national. That's the problem that I have, is that that one person, those two people, the 10 people, I heard there were 6 people in the home, including the mother. And I don't know how true that is, and I don't know the actual context of this article, but if there's one person in the home, another adult in the home, and still that to me is is what that needs to be challenged within our Caribbean community big time, because that's what happens. We have become a group of people. We have become people who are so passive in our life that we are willing to allow atrocities to happen simply because why? It's going to hinder or stop us from what? Making a friend, making some more money, buying a car. What? Is it that important for you that you will allow a child to be raped, that you will see something that's so wrong? Or you may even have an inkling of it. Something isn't right. But yet, because you don't want to embarrass yourself, you don't want to embarrass your family, or you're trying to protect the name of your family, we don't want nobody to know about that. That's a family business. That's a family affair. That's the issue to me, that we will always have people who will try to push the limit and be deviant in the way that they think about children and young girls and women. That's not going to change. History tells us that. So we're not going to eradicate that as much as I would love to. The problem is, though, are those that stand by and allow it, whether it's politically, whether it's economically, whether it's physically, socially. They allow this rape, this violation to happen. That's the issue. I had a very, as much anger and hatred, and I'm glad I've moved through that, but I had a lot of anger and hatred towards the family dynamic as a whole, because I saw as a little kid.
And this is probably something that maybe I don't know if research has ever done on this kind of a thing, because if abuser A abuses child A at Miss A's house, it is quite likely that abuser A is abusing child C and child E and child F and child H and child Y. And therefore, it is the responsibility, I think, once you have an abuser and it's found out, the entire family should know about it and the entire community to know about it, so people can come in and say, hey, you know what? Or the little young girl who is there can be saved from him. Because I think, I don't know if I'm correct to say, once an abuser is an abuser, if we can generalize that. But let's say that, because it has to be, not because he's seen you at a particular situation or vulnerability, that he or she does whatever he does. That means it's only you particularly that he will do it with. I would think that he has been doing it with others, will continue to do it with others, and therefore there's some alarm that needs to be made to save the other little girl. So, for example, I think that one of the situations that needs to happen is whoever your abuser is. I mean, everybody in his family, because one is going to be holding the secret. If they don't make sure that everybody knows about it. You see what I'm trying to say? That person, if he does it at 10, 15 years old, if they get served, and especially if nobody knows or is a hush-hush thing between yourself and whoever you're going to talk to, who is not going to take an action to find this person and let him pay. He is out there doing it, and he will continue to do it. The young girls in the family are not safe.
Right. And I know from my abusers, they were my cousins. And so when I confronted one, so we all lived in different places, and it just so happens we were all in the military, and one of them was a Marine like I was, and we were close together. And I remember going to him. And at this time, he was sick. He actually had a stroke. And I remember going to him and saying, you know, I remember these things happening, and I don't hate you. I'm trying to understand what happened, why. I just want to have some clarity for myself. And his this first cousin said, you know what, I don't know what you're talking about. That must have been the other cousin. I had nothing to do with that. And so that was his approach. And I said, well, you know what, I know you did it, and you know you did it. So for me, that was all I could get from that. I walked away from that just letting him know that I know it happened and you know it happened. And so no matter much you deny it or don't want to deal with it, I know it happened. And so that was the end of that conversation. Mm-hmm. He unfortunately passed a couple years after that. And my second cousin, who was disconnected for many years, called me out of the blue one day. It must have been about maybe 2 years ago. And at the time, he obviously, from what the conversation him and I had, he got into the church, and he was having some difficulty with his wife, and he was just calling family members for prayer. And so I listened to him. We talked, and I said, of course I will pray. And then he wanted to get in a deeper conversation about his family and what he was struggling with, and I had to stop him, and I said, hold up. I said, I absolutely don't mind praying for you and talking to you, but I said, I have to be honest with you that before we can have any deeper conversation about God and, you know, God's love and forgiveness, I said, I need to address something with you. And at that time, he said to me, he said, Camille, I know what you are getting ready to say. And I said, well, I know. He said, I know what you're getting ready to say, and I am so sorry. I am so sorry that I did that to you. He said, I know that it affected your life. I know that it affected the way you think of yourself as a woman, as a person, and I am sorry. He said, there is no excuse for that. It was done to me as a young boy, and so I did it. And for me, that was a moment of true redemption, because that was a God divine thing. Huh? Whoever you want to label the divine as, for me, that was a divine intervention, because the conversation, that was only therapeutic for me to hear, just to have the conversation. I didn't want it to be about conflict. I didn't want it to be about hatred or anything. I wanted to be literally about what was going on. Why did you do that? What was happening with you? Did you know how it affected me? And everything that I desired to have in that conversation, it manifested. And so we ended the conversation 3 hours later. Both of us really meeting the divine in that space and being redeemed from that experience that we had together. You know, that experience that happened together. It was a bad thing. It happened, but it didn't have to end with me hating him and him feeling worthless the rest of his life, or me walking around feeling this sense of shame and burden about treated this way. It didn't have to end that way. And that, to me, was what's important, was that we both were able to come mutually to the table to have a conversation, to acknowledge the pain, to acknowledge the abuse, to acknowledge the infraction, and acknowledge that violence that was perpetuated more so against my psyche. You know, and we did that, and healing happened for me in ways that I could still feel the effect.
Now, tell me, the thing about it, here is somebody who definitely got away with just, it's between you and him, and he says, okay, I did something wrong. Oh, she forgives me, and I am good now. I'm whole. But he has not paid for all the things that he has done to you.
For me, the payment, and when you talk about payment for me, I'm not sure what that means, but statutes of limitation.
Payment, he is, whatever would have come with somebody who abused or raped someone, he just got off.
I don't look at it as he got off. For me, in that moment, what was more important was the fact that I was on a road to be healed. It wasn't that my family didn't know about it. They did. It wasn't that it was a secret. It wasn't. And so that moment for me was more about me letting him know that what happened wasn't good. It wasn't right. I didn't want that to be the covering under that situation. It was It was already out. My sisters knew about it. Since then, I've talked about it, and I've opened it up. So for me, that particular dynamic
also,
was about.
Do we know that this person is not continuing to do that to some other girl in the family?
Well, I don't know if he's doing it within. No, I don't know that. I don't know if he's. I could almost say no, he's not. I could almost say that in a positive way, he's not, because it's out. It's not something that's not. It's not covered. It's out,
okay.
And so.
Okay.
Wherever he is, whatever dynamic he's in, it's there. So, you know, I'm not going to be the one to follow him and find out where he is. I'm going to allow him to work that out on his own, meaning whatever he has to confront because it's been exposed and he has to deal with that. No, the molestation his molestation against me is not something that was, persecuted, or there was no legal action. And I think the dynamic was at that time, because of his age as well, he was maybe 4 years my senior. So he was also a minor in that dynamic. And, right. For the gentleman that raped me, when we moved, I mean, it was somebody that was just in the neighborhood.
Caribbean lady, question chatter in the room. Many think, we're talking about the Christianity, many think reborn Christian can be same from alcoholism and drug addiction, but many do not think molestation can be changed.
Yeah, I am.
Then if that is the case, then these people have to be called out when somebody realizes and have enough strength, because they will be continually molesting throughout their lives.
That's a very, very difficult. In a situation like mine, and again, I could only speak for my situation, because it was such a, and this is going to sound, and it has sounded weird or nasty to me for most of my life, but it was a family dynamic for a long time. And the family dynamic was such that it was not just molestation, it was incestual. And so incest in the family, in my experience and from what I've learned from my own family dynamic, was it happened. It was something that was happening. And there's a dynamic with incestual molestation, meaning you're molesting family members. It's a family affair, kind of. Right, exactly. There's a dynamic with that, Dr. Eve, that we would probably definitely would love to bring an expert on and talk some more about that, because there is a dynamic in this that it's beyond the scope of my education, and I could definitely speak on it from my own experience, but the ancestral part of it is, it's family. This is something that my family have experienced. From what I have learned in the research that I've done within my own family, I was not the first, neither was my sisters, or my cousins. And so that's a dynamic that needs to be. And from what I'm hearing, recently I had a trip to Jamaica in 2008, and I had a conversation with a cousin that still lives in Jamaica. And she just shared some things with me that was so disturbing. But what I learned from that conversation, that there, from my own experience, that is a very embedded, that's the only way I could say it, is an embedded way of being within the culture that my family was a part of, that that's part of what my passion is in going back to Jamaica. That's part of what propels me constantly to want to go back and to create a voice and a conversation about this situation, about rape and about molested. But we haven't talked a lot about it, Dr. E, the incestual dynamic that happens. And that's something, it can get very, that is an experience and a conversation, and to be all honest, especially amongst Caribbeans, that I've had a lot more conversations about versus just the molestation itself. That it's, there's an incestual component to it that is, it's almost like there's a permission. There's something going on with the incestual part of it that I still have yet to figure out. And so when you talk about rape, you talk about molestation, and you talk about incest, those dynamics, I've experienced all three of them. And it's a dynamic that's very different.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, let's
take some chatter from the room here. Pauline, good evening, my sister. Good evening to you, and welcome to the show. She has a lot of chatter here before. Let's take this last one here. When we look at ourselves as animal instead of men, with a mind that is superior to animal, then we ask, what is a man feeling like when they want sex so bad that they take a child's virginity and damage their life? Maybe the dog and men are the same thing. I'm not laughing, but I mean, that's a question also, and I'm hoping to get we're hoping to get an expert in human sexuality, and of course, she's on a conference now, but we hope to get her in at a very sometime down the line. Somebody else brought up that question. Already, I mean, that men sometimes, especially at a certain age, that they want sex so much that it there are totally, it's like a mental illness, as what they say. I mean, until they get to that point where this act is done, and it doesn't matter what is before them. I mean, a lot of them are more mentally ill when they're going to be looking at an 8-month baby and really ravish that body to death.
And I think there's some mental. I'm sorry. I think there. I think Caribbean lady. There's definitely some mental illness. It's a mental. I mean, that 18-year-old and the father was 18 years old. There's something going on there. I mean. Reality check here. We have to look at that. There's something going on in this young man's head to say that's beyond, because power, sex is about power and control. When you do that to a baby it's a baby. They're looking to you to protect them. There is no power and control in this position. There's got to be something beyond the fact that it's just sex. When you go and you actually try to, you stick your penis into a baby 8 days old. There's something going on in that dynamic, and that's part of the conversation, too, that we want to have. And there's a question on here about can sexual deviant, can that be changed, can it be cured? And the question you brought up, I don't know if it's about a cure issue. I think there's some components to it that are outside the realm of just medicine. You know what I mean? I'm of the belief when you have this serious sexual deviant and a person who's just in that space of thinking about women a particular way, no, I don't know if that's a cure for that. I don't know if there's something that you can necessarily cure. But I like what Apple Pie says here on the chatter. It's like the only way to stop sex abuse is to protect potential victims. And that's where I think the power comes for us. I mean, think about that. If we are educating people, we're talking about it, we're exposing it, like you said, then the person who molested someone in a family like my cousin is not going to be able to go back and molest somebody because it's out. The cover has been taken off.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the dynamic, part of the issue within the church, if you think about that pastor that told that mom, don't tell anybody, you know, could the church have done something different in that dynamic? Could the church have said, of course. Could they have exposed
that?
Of course.
That would have saved the little girl from being raped. I mean,
again and again and again.
And
then even think about the Penn State dynamic, that fiasco.
Uh-huh.
This, that coach that walked into the locker room and saw this man raping this little boy and walked out. He reported it to another official, but it stopped there. So it's almost like he's saying, well, I told somebody about it. But who else did you? Did you go to the news? Did you confront this coach? What was going on?
For example, if you walk up and then act like that, are you yourself who are witnessing that you think we become so numb and lifeless as if we are being raped as well to have witnessed such a thing that we cannot tell?
That's a great question. I mean, that's a great question. Sometimes we become desensitized to certain things because we have experienced it or we have been exposed to it in a way that either evokes a sense of fear or it evokes a sense of it's not that big of a deal. I mean, powerlessness, I don't know. Maybe that assistant coach was raped. You know, but I know the response.
Or maybe you go and you see these things. Because can you imagine you go, and this is why I think, I'm not sure, I'm not an expert in the field. I haven't done any research, but I'm just thinking in my own self. As a woman, you see a coach. This is an important, all of a sudden, all of these in a flash, everything starts to come into your mind. You see a coach, a very respectable person, normally he's in the church, and he holds this powerhouse, and all of a sudden you see this happening, and you're left to say, did I really see that? No, maybe I am just thinking that in my head. And then you will go to somebody close and say, boy, let me tell you something. I'm going to say something to you. But, this is just so way off the chart that please don't look at me in any maybe crazy because I was not crazy. I know I see this. And you're trying to convince the person even before you put down this information to them. Hey, I've seen something, but I believe you me, this is what I saw. I know I've seen it. I've seen it there. I mean, what can I do about this? I remember, and I'm feeling this too because I have gone through a situation like that I was so frightened out of my brain. I had I was doing a daycare center some years ago, and this little boy went into the bathroom with his brother. I didn't see what happened, but I hear the conversation. Hey, you don't want me to come into the bathroom. I was looking at him and saying, why is this little kid? He was about 8 and his brother was about 5. And every time he wants to go to the bathroom, he would rush to the bathroom with this kid. And not having, and here is where education comes in again. Me not thinking that any baby in my little mind is capable of doing this. But something kind of aroused me and said, why is this kid going into the bathroom all the time? But I always actually said, he's helping his brother in the bathroom. But I said, you don't really need to help him anymore. And he goes in and he shuts the door. And then one day I just pulled beside the door and listened. He says, oh, you don't want me to come into the bathroom anymore with you because you don't want me to push this in your ass.
Wow.
You see what I'm saying? So here is somebody who is put over. When I heard that, I was like out of my brain. I was trembling. I didn't know what to do. Do I call the authorities? I didn't see this kid saying anything, but this is what I heard. Do I tell the mom, as the mom is going to say, that I'm making things up? I mean, who on earth would I tell this to that they do not believe that I am crazy? So in thinking about this, and this is only... all of this is gelling because we're having this conversation here now. I did call somebody and talk to somebody, I mean, trembling like crazy. And I talked to the mom Eventually, when I kind of got her at a point, because these folks are, you know, I mean, certain folks who are people who would get up and cuss you and don't feel any way to do your arm. This was the kind of a situation, and I'm just so nervous. When can I tell this lady, so maybe this is going on and something is going on here that she should be alerted of and maybe try to address? Then, you know, keeping the kids for a little while, I start to pay attention. Then a lot of other things that she was involved with that they were seeing. So how do you tell this mom things that she's doing is affecting these kids? Mm. And how do you go to the authority, tell the authority they're going to another home, that they are further abused because they are being abused? So somebody who is there as an abuse, these abused children get into a home and they kind of expose this abuse thing, and if that person who is looking after them can get in to start abusing these kids already again. You understand what I'm saying there? I don't know if I said that correctly. A child who is abused, they kind of behave a certain way. Mm-hmm. Will this trigger somebody maybe who never been abused to start abusing these kids because they're open to the abuse? You understand what I'm saying?
Oftentimes, from what my research and just what I've, you know, and I'm not an expert, but oftentimes what happens with someone, especially a young child, because children that age, basically they enact, they do what they see. And so if you come across a child that is acting, you know, overly sexual, that are, you know, saying things overly sexual, that are doing things outside the norm of that their age dynamic, their own development, and it's you're questioning, like, why is this child, you know, doing certain, you most often that child has been abused. Now if you put that child in a situation where there's another child there, then more than likely, if the scenario is right, then that child is going to try to experiment, meaning they're going to try to reproduce or recreate the act that was done upon them on that other child. So it's not 100%, but it's more than likely that's what happens. That's through research. And I know for me, one of the things that scared the shit out of me for the longest time, until I just got a better understanding of myself and who I was that, and I heard this statement, I think it was on Oprah or another talk show, that says most often, you know, people who are abused become abusers. And I don't know what else was said in that dynamic, but that's all I heard. And when I heard that, I was scared. I was like, oh, my God, so does that mean this was before I had my child. Like, does it mean I'm going to be an abuser? Does it mean I'm going to do this? I mean, I really was terrified that I was going to become the person or someone like you know, the person that abused me. And it was not until I learned more about the dynamic and what that meant and all of that, that fear was alleviated for me. I didn't become an abuser. I didn't abuse anybody. But at the same time, if the situation is left unchecked, whether you're a child or an adult and you grow up and having these inclinations towards a child or hurting a child or hurting, then you definitely need to pay attention to that. If you recognize that within your child, if you have a niece, a nephew, a daughter, son, whatever, and you see for yourself, like, they're being overly sexual, you know, they're being overly aggressive. It's always. You may not know exactly what it is. It may not have led to any kind of penetration or any kind of, you know, direct violence. It may have been just things that was insinuated. It may have just been a kiss or a touch, but something. Do not believe it.
One of the things, I have a question. You know, something just occurred to me today. I was having a conversation today. Is it today or yesterday? But I'm going to mention it. But before I do that, let me go to chatter. We hear, okay. Pauline was saying that, maybe Caribbean lady was saying there was an adult male in a class, some sexual therapy class, and one of the things that was brought out in the class by this male, that his penis was very small, and he was getting complained that he wasn't satisfying women, so he turned to very young girls. Do you think that sometimes inadequacy, these guys may feel inadequate, so they try to say, okay, a developed woman is going to complain, so I'm going to go to a small child?
You know, there may be some components to that. I would definitely say that. I know that sexual violence at its core is about power and control. And so, yes, if they feel like they're not going to be able to be in control of or have worth with a woman that's maybe going to criticize the size of their penis, and they feel like they're going to get that control from a child, then, yeah, that's because that's what that kind of violation is about. And most times,
but also when most men are having sexual intercourse, they a lot of them do not understand it's a sharing of body and spirit and this whatever that done in a loving way. Some of them still do sexual act as a conquest, even in a consenting way, very violent in itself as well.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Wow, yeah. I was just reading one of the posts on the blog here. It says, you cannot tame man's hormones. And maybe part of the dynamic in that is that we are associating this kind of, because you don't have to tame a man's hormones. You know what I mean? To me, like saying that men are just sexual animals and they just can't control themselves. And so because they have that urge, they can go and just have sex. No, that's violence. Sexual violence is about power. And we got to make sure we maintain that it's about power and control. It's not about the act itself. The act is just a part of that dynamic, but it's about controlling someone. And if a pedophile most often can control a child's mind. That's why they're so successful, because they can use, ways that they will never be able to work on a woman. Never. They can entice a child with candy. They can entice a child with a puppy. They can entice a child with just paying attention to them because their parents are working. They can entice a child with things that children like. So they know that they can control that child. They can control that situation. And that's why the internet and being in chat rooms and being on Facebook is so powerful for these individuals, because they're literally creating a world of a child's dream, and they're literally drawing that child, especially if you find a child who is not getting attention, who doesn't have the support around them. So it's about power and control. The penis size and all that, that's not a – it may be a factor in individual cases, but it's not a factor overall. Someone is feeling like they want to cause violence on a child. It's because that's what they want. It's a choice they're making. It doesn't have anything to do with their hormones or anything about what they're getting or not getting from a woman. It's because that's what they're going after. That's something that's feeding some desire in them. It's giving them some sense of control over the person that they're seeking after. And is it possible? And I was just go ahead, Doctor.
I was saying back, and I don't think I've gotten to the point where, I mean, is it that person who's witnessing this power, and a lot of these real retarded behavior, I would say, are done by some people in power and control, big time power and control. So you witnessing this, you one is just thinking, gosh, this person is the pastor. I mean, we cannot afford to make our pastor feel good, but feel bad because everybody's going to look at me, say, I shouldn't have done that. They're always looking at the victim. You know what? You shouldn't have gone to the police. You should have come to us so we can deal with this indoors because we have a little problem because it's a little sex. And you blow it out of proportion. What I mean, because part of this program here is to help us to cry out. If we were teaching our children to holler out like how they're doing the fire drills. Now, once upon a time, you usually do it differently, but they feel out. If you're telling these kids who are being adopted to scream out, it's the same thing if we talk to our kids, not when they get to 10 and 15 and 14
right.
and all of that,
that's
because
right.
a lot of damage is done way before that. Teach the kids at a certain age and constantly teach them that these are situations that they should not tolerate from no one, no way, no how. Holler out immediately. Let them also know that when somebody says, do not tell your mommy or daddy or I'm going to kill all of them or whatever they use along with that, that would be a signal to them to say, okay, that's the signal there. That means mommy must know this or daddy must know this. Or, you know, you tell them if they're going to give you this or they're going to take you to Disney or something like that. Anytime they associate those things, that should be a clear signal in the child's brain. The other thing that I'm going to talk about quickly that really triggered me yesterday, I spoke to you. We have our little kids, and we send them off to the thing called sleepover. Do we really, really know what's going on there?
Mm-mm.
And I've read in a lot of cases that's where a lot of things start happening in these sleepovers. I mean, how well do you know the child that is sleeping over with your child? How well do you know the sleeping arrangement? How well do you know the parents who are encouraging this or sleepover? These are some of the things that we really should look at. I mean, do we take our kids away from the situation where we don't let them socialize anymore and that stuff? But are sleepovers really one of the signs? Because you get mushy-mushy and play-play
right.
and all of those kind of things. I mean, are these things that we have to take a close look at? You can't really prejudge a lot of times, but
right.
This is where a lot of these things can happen.
Yeah, I have a rule as a mom. That I need to meet, not just go and shake hands and say, oh, I met you, but I need to meet. I need to sit down, have a conversation, go into their house, meet the family that's in that home, the parents, before my child can go and spend any kind of time in another adult's home. That's just my personal rule that I need to know, not just on a superficial level, but I need to know who is my child hanging out with. Yes, they're going to go play with the baby that's there, the girl or the little boy that's there, but there's also adults in that home. There's father, mother, there's extended family. And so for me, to say, oh, my daughter has a play date is not enough. And so I extend that to every parent, too, that my daughter has friends that want to come over here. I said, I need to meet the parents before your mom or before you can come and play. I need to meet your family before you can come into my home because – again, that setting that child over to my house and not knowing me tells me something about that parent. That means my child will never be able to go over their house because if they're so free and so open and say, oh, just go hang out with, you know, Trinity, and that's Trinity's mom, and don't know me, that means you're not really looking out for your kid that well. That's me. That's my experience. That's how I decide where my children are going to go. So I'm not going to allow anybody to go, my daughter to go to anybody's house if they're not even going to take the time to come and meet me before they send their child over to my house. And you, a lot of times you have situations where parents feel comfortable because the kid knows, you know, they're this person from school, their little friend from school or from the neighborhood, and they say, oh, that's just such and such. You know, they can go over there and play. That's not how that's not a good way to be.
Wow. One of the things, and let's pay attention to this a little bit if we can. In the chat I hear from Caribbean Lady, and as you bring that up, I kind of see a picture. There are some 8 and 9 year old kids, especially you're beautiful, you start to develop, the curves start to come on you too early, the boobs start to develop, and as Caribbean Lady says, this is a target for a sexual target right there. A seven-year-old developing her boobs, and because you're 7 year-old, you're still behaving like a kid. A 9 year-old behaving like a kid with your boobs and everything, all of that kind of really setting up you as a target. If you have a young daughter that is well developed, I think that this should be a signal to the family to, hey, let's pay attention. Unfortunately, you in the sleeping over and the really playing with the cousin too much, because a lot of the cousin thing happens. I mean, we have to be particularly paying attention to you, which might make the child a little bit uncomfortable.
Right. Yeah, and you're right. I've had many, because we're a military family, we traveled and went all over the place, and so our neighbors and our community changed often. And so it was just a habit that I came into to make sure that my daughters, you know, that was one of the things. It was not even enough for me to ask the questions. It wasn't enough, and they did not go and hang out with anybody until they were at the age where they could articulate to me, you know, when they would feel like they would be in danger, when something that they felt wasn't appropriate. And when I talk to them about protecting themselves and trusting their instincts, I don't just tell them, oh, if they touch your breast or if they touch your bottom. I said, if they touch your face, they try to just hug you. If they compliment you on your clothes, if they touch your neck.
Wow.
I try to let them know that this person, what they're doing is seducing a child. You're having an adult seducing a child. And I remember Oprah did a show some years ago, and she made that statement, and it clicked so deeply in me, because that's exactly what pedophiles do. This is what people who are seeking to hurt children do. And we're not talking about this gentleman that raped his – there's something going on in this man's head. We're talking about people who are out there that are purposely and intentionally seeking out to have relationships with children. Don't get it twisted. They are out there. And what they do is they're seducing your children. And they may compliment them, boys and girls, on their clothes. They may compliment them on their grades. They may compliment them on – they do – so I taught my children very early on that inappropriate behavior from an adult does not mean only, you know, touching them in an obviously – you know, part like their breast or their bottom or their stomach. I tell them it's them touching them in a way that, because it sends a radar. If the child is feeling uncomfortable, that's number one. So the adult may say, you know, rub their back in a way that's like, wait a minute, why is he still rubbing my back like that? They may hug them like, what, that doesn't feel comfortable. If they may look at them and that child feels uncomfortable, I tell my children, you come and you tell me immediately. You don't have to wait until somebody's walking around in their underwear.
Mm-hmm.
Big sign. You don't have to to wait until somebody take their shirt off in the house, that's a big sign. So part of this is teaching our children, you know, and I think Apple Pie said it before, it's about stopping it from happening again. And how do we do that? We educate not just the children but the parents. We educate communities.
Mm-hmm.
And especially communities like in Jamaica, where I'm from, vital, Dr. E, vital, because just last year I had this conversation with someone that's still living in Jamaica, that this kind of, you know, seduction and this incest and this molestation and this rape, it's happening in such a way that the community has kind of like, I don't know, I hate to use the word accept as norm, but it's almost like it's been accepted as a normal way of being. That must not and cannot happen anymore. Cannot.
And you have what some folks do to, and you have some folks who, because of their belief system, believe that they, if they have sex with a virgin girl or a little girl, certain things, they would be cured of certain diseases and all of that kind of a stuff, or certain spiritual stuff. That's the thing that we haven't even looked at, too, because some of these men, they would get some amount of power by getting involved in these acts with young girls.
Yes. Yes. And, you know, and I think we had hit, you just brought something to my mind. I know we are just kind of talking about everything tonight, but what you just reminded me of was a conversation that we will definitely have again on this show when we talked about the increase of AIDS and HIV in the Caribbean, in Jamaica, and the kind of import, the sexual imports that come into the island and have sex with these young girls, because the increase of AIDS and HIV it's a pandemic in Jamaica, and it's from ages 9 years old to, I think, 19, where this number is growing in ways that the health department in Jamaica is having some problems trying to understand it, why it's such a pandemic. But there's one of the scenarios is, and I went on the UN site, one of the scenarios is that we have people coming from Europe and overseas and going into Jamaica and having sex with these young girls because, again, like you just said, there's that experience of having sex with a Caribbean. It's like an exotic thing, an exotic experience. Or there's this belief that if they come and they have sex with, they have AIDS, they come into the island, they have sex with these young girls, somehow they have sex with these virgins, these young virgins, it's somehow going to help them, the HIV and AIDS that they have. And what happens is that they end up giving this disease to these kids. So the conversation is very layered and it's very deep. When we talk about molestation, we talk about, you know, that sexual violation, it's deep and it's wide when it comes to especially a country like Jamaica in the Caribbean, where it's so disenfranchised from the rest of Latin America. It's so poor. It's so poor that there's the resources to be educated, to learn for young girls are so limited. So we cannot talk about educating our community and educating our young girls without talking about the need to bring resources and empowerment to these communities where these men who have been taught that women are property, that women are owned. They can go and have sex with them and whenever they want to because that's what they're there for. So the conversation has to be deeper and broader than this: the molestation and the rape and the violation and these men that kind of take possession, this control. It has to be, how do we change the dynamic? How do we teach young women, young girls, how to empower themselves to pay attention? That sexual violation just starts off as a very seductive, as a very, you know, it doesn't just lead up to, unless you're talking about a violent rapist, penetration is not the first part of this experience. that they lead, they go
the
into
sexual the sexual act.
Yes, it's a seduction.
Mm-hmm.
It's a seduction. It's exactly what happens. It's a way of making the young girl feel comfortable, so that that penetration can happen. So the conversation is broad and deep, and that's why we, when we talk about it on the show, we have to be aware that this conversation is so broad and deep, and I'm loving to hear someone calling in right now and just be a part of this conversation. I know the chat room is just blown up. I know a lady, a Caribbean lady was saying in Indiana during the 70s, they wanted to pass laws on male castration. And that's a very interesting, they're still trying to pass that law from in Chicago, she's saying, from the 70s till now. They're still trying to pass that law. Why is it so difficult, Dr. Eve, to create laws and policies to stop men in whatever way that we've come up with it from doing these kind of violations? But it's much easier.
The thing about it, what you have to realize is that when you have some of these men, and because some of them haven't been caught, a lot of these people in the high places, and the politics, they are engaged into what they would have called these exotic things. And who is in control of laws? They are men, and it's going to be perpetrated against them. So it is going to be difficult for you to get these laws enacted against them. You see what I'm saying? So this is why groups and like us women getting together, and I'm constantly in awe why we women are not flooding and getting together at a rate that, you know, would make the change. We are, because we have husbands, because our particular husbands, we think, and we have to say we think, are doing the right thing and out there doing, because you can never tell what a person is doing, no matter how they're around. Normally, sometime when you get one of these abusers, they're model citizens, and you would never tell nothing is going on. If women, I'm telling my thing to make sure that this doesn't continue, and if every single woman would get together, as I said before, have this sisterhood locked down. We are all sisters, and we really take this seriously. We look out for each other's interests. Our child on the outside, we look out for the child on the outside as if it were all our own child, because we are the mothers, right? If we would, I mean, you have a sister who have me and your friends, and I look at your man, if I should make sure that I keep your man intact, that when he starts his little nasty hormonal stuff, I say, you know what? You're not going to be able to do that to me. So if the sisters are not trying to get their sister's man, and we try to hold it together for ourselves, all of this is going to be men. Here's what this will happen. Our men would have to respect us, because when a sister come over to your house, that man would know that he cannot bring on anything to her, because she will not allow it. It means that when we sit down to talk as sisters, we will be able to look out for your children, no matter where they are in the universe. It means that when a sister sends a sister to have a sleepover, her eyes would be watching those children like an
hawk.
It means that whatever is there, these are her precious kids. So there is no time for me or any sister to ever turn her eyes away from seeing some disadvantage of another sister's child, which is any child in the world, and she turn her eyes away. So if we could get to the point where sisters are really and truly sisters, we will eliminate 99% of the disadvantage to us, and as well as the disadvantage to our children, as well as the entire world will be able to heal themselves just by women being women and being respectable to each other. No sister would be looking at any sister. I mean, I was looking at one thing on the F-book here not too long ago. A donkey was dressed up like having a pants on, a hat and all of that. You know, gadgetry they put onto him and really make him a fancy donkey. I find fun in that. But one of the ladies said, she looked better than the gal then. This donkey looked better than the gal then. And I mean, I'm just saying to myself, wow, my laughing and my appreciation for this donkey being dressed up and it was so funny stopped. Because here is a sister pulling down another sister, tearing her up. Here is a sister talking to me without she knowing that, and that this is something that is embedded in her, that she is going to be talking. I can imagine how she talked to her sister on the road, the B word, every kind of derogatory word. Who is doing that? This is not the man doing that. It's us, sister. And when we get to fighting with each other, we can be cruel worse than men. So until women realize that we have to stop perpetrating violence against each other, then all of these things, we're going to be having people turning a blind eye. We're going to be having somebody holding, some woman holding a little girl for some other person to rape her. Because we ourselves are need healing and sick, and we need to get together on a level that we will be able to take care of each other wherever we are.
Yes, and that's exactly right, that we have to develop that sisterhood. You're actually right. When we could have multiple eyes in the community looking out not just for ourselves but for our children, and that is really the issue. You know, that is the issue. How do we develop that community? How do we start this conversation? We can talk about rape and being raped and molested and violated forever, because it's something that has happened. We have deviants that are think outside of the norm of what, you know, God wants, what God created it to be. And I believe in a God, I believe in a divine that is loving. I don't interpret the Bible and look at God as a God that designed me to be less than because I'm a woman. God empowered me as much as and I believe actually even more than at times men, because of just who I am and what I bring to the table. I don't need to feel like I am somebody's wife or somebody's, you know, girlfriend or somebody's beloved, for me, a man's beloved, for me to feel like God has somehow set things right in the world. I don't need that kind of affirmation. What I need is to create a better community, a more loving community of my sisters, of women who believe in their power. This is not about diminishing anybody's authority. No man, it's not about making men, you know, into dogs and making them less than. I love men. God created men, so I love men. But I don't love a man more than myself, and I don't love a man so much that I would deny my child or I deny another child the opportunity to live and free and be and develop in a healthy way. Everything has to be in balance. Everything has to be in balance. That God didn't design men to be so full of hormones and so full of whatever it is, testosterone or whatever, that they could go and just rape women because women are dressed a particular way. No. Men make choices just like women make choices. But as a woman, we have to develop that connection within amongst ourselves. We think too small of our sister. We think too little of the woman that's in our community. That's the issue, not what the men are doing. Once you develop that connection, that community, and trust each other, we will be able to protect our children better. We will be able to educate our men and love them the way they need to be loved. We will be able to give our men what they need, because the reality is they need to be taught just like our children need to be taught. They're not exempt. Men are not exempt from learning from women. Men are not exempt from being educated by women because they're men. And it's not to say that women don't need to be taught by men, but look at history. Look at the way things have been done. Who has been doing the teaching? Who has set up the society the way it is? Who has structured things the way they are? And how is that going? Like Dr. Phil asked, how is that working for you? We need to there's some things that, look, we need to change some things, because we can have this conversation about abuse and rape and violation all day, every day, and still come up with the same scenario. Yes, it happens. It needs to not happen, and it's about power and control. The reality is, though, things need to change. And who, if we look at the way things have been done, now I'm married to the most awesome man ever. David is not only my husband, but he's my best friend. And I actually prefer to call him my best friend, because for me that evokes a sense of more respect, a sense of more connection than saying he's my husband. That's a title that's been given. Him being my best friend says that we are in a partnership together. And that's what needs to happen, that we as women need to start defining not just who we are in society, in our homes, but the roles that we play in our community and in the world. We need to stop allowing these definitions to be handed to us. So now we are trying to fulfill the role of a God that designed us to be less than a man. Let's stop that. I was talking to someone recently, and they were talking about the roles and the responsibilities of men and how God ordered creation. And we were on the same page until we got to this statement she made. That God ordered the world a certain way, and the men are to lead. And I'm like, hold up. Let's back up. And then she referred back to a scripture in the text, Genesis, the creation story, and she referred to one of the creation stories, okay? One of the creation stories said that God created Adam and took Eve out of Adam's rib. That's one of the creation story. I'm not fighting against it. I'll preach it. But there's also another creation story, that God created Adam and Eve together, side by side, equal. And I preach that too. And so as women, we've been taught the first one. We came out of Adam's rib. So God didn't just create us like he created Adam and breathe breath into us like he did Adam. Oh, God knows. God had to take us out of somebody else. That's the lie that has been perpetuated for far too long. We need to reorder our society now. And women, and I'm talking to my sisters, I'm talking to women, stop allowing your definition to be that of one that is handed to you. You are being challenged by me. Create the definition of who you are yourself. God gave you that right, just like God gave your brother, your father, your husband, your son, that same right. That is when you take that position, you will not be less than. You will never say that again. You will never accept that definition again, ever. Because you have been given authority to be the author of your own life. God gave you the book, the pen, a full of pages to write on. You now write your story. The pen comes from your divine. The book comes from your divine. Now you write the story, not your husband. I don't care if he is the pastor of the church. That is part of the lie to me that allows some of this disconnection that we are seeing in our communities now, is that we are, as women, we are waiting for our husbands and our sons and our fathers to get it together so now we can have a life. I have a big problem with that. Not because I hate men. I love men. Believe me, we can talk about that some other time. And I will tell you the reasons why some other time. I love men. This is not about hatred, but men have been in this position of authority since it's been written in the book. They wrote the books. Y'all, come on. They write the stories. When are we as women going to stand up and say, no, we need to write our own, we need to add our own biblical text? The Bible is continually being written. Recognize that, especially as Christians, if you are out there, you are part of the Bible. You are part of the biblical text. When are the women going to write their own lamentations? When are we going to write our own Psalms? When are we going to write our own Genesis? When are we going to write our own Revelation? When are we going to recognize that we've been given that authority? All this, these things that we're talking about, the abuse, the violation, I'm not saying it will not happen if women take a deeper and more stronger role in their homes and in their communities, because again, as before, deviant is deviant. That has nothing to do with what I'm saying. That's going to happen. But if we develop as women a stronger connection to who we are, who we were designed to be, powerful, strong, assertive, dominant, yes, that's who I am. I am not afraid to take control of my life anymore. I am not afraid to say that I am a strong-ass woman. But does it mean that I hate men, that I don't love my husband, that I don't love my brothers, my father, my... No. It means that I'm helping them now be who they've been called to be. Yes, I said it. We are helping men be who they've been called to be because they got it wrong. In so many ways. So many ways. So, yes, me walking in my power, in my authority, in my dominance, I'm helping my brother. I'm helping my husband. I'm helping your son. I'm helping your father, your uncle, to be who they've been called to be. They need a strong woman like me.
Mm-hmm.
And they need a strong woman like you. We need to help them. That's the conversation that I'm ready to have with my sisters. How can we be who, what we need to be so we can help our men be who they're supposed to be? Because they need our help, for real. This is not about bashing nobody. Our men need us to help them. Come on now. They need us to help them to love us, to take care of us, to take care of themselves. They have not gotten it right. Now, we got some men out there that are doing some amazing things. Don't get it wrong. But overall, history tells us, the wars tell us, the destructions of societies and communities tell us. We need the communication to change. We need the language to change. Women, I'm inviting you in this conversation in a different way. Take your authority. Stop waiting for somebody to give it to you. I'm sorry, Doctor. You go ahead.
Let's take a call in. No, but sister, you have to say. Let's take a call in. 323. Good evening. You're on the mic with Sister Camille and Doctor L.
Good evening.
Greetings to everyone on the panel. This is Keith Clizark from Los Angeles.
Hi, Keith. Thank you for calling in.
I just came in on part of, you know, your session, and what I'm hearing is very fascinating. And to the woman who was just speaking, the sister who was just speaking, you have a lot of great points. But at the same time, you can't lump all men in one category. You feel me? There's certain treatment from white men than black men. And just my second point is, in order for women, let me acknowledge this first. Women, everything comes from a woman. A woman is everything, supreme, everything. And before this mess, we're now this patriotic society, we was in a matriotic society. That's when we had peace, you know, when the women ruled everything. So I feel you on a lot of points, but in order to help us black men, you have to know the cause of our fall. Other than that, you're running on a treadmill. You can never help us.
Mm-hmm. So what's the cause of your fall, Keith? Help me out. Assuming that I don't know that, educate me and help other sisters out and help us to understand that. Because I don't lump all men in the same category. I understand the cultural, the historical issues that are coming along with that. But I want you to expound on that a little bit. I'm interested to hear what you're saying.
I mean, it's kind of complex, but to put it in a nutshell, I mean, just to know who you are and where you truly came from. And just speaking, a lot of men don't know their history past slavery.
Right.
You know, and that's one big cause right there of why we deteriorated to be how we are now. But I say until we know who we truly are and where we came from, and I know that's cliche, but truly get into the work, the study of who we are and where we came from, then we can begin to rebuild the black man, you know?
Now, I'm going to put you on the spot. I want you to tell me how to do that. Give me just one thing. Tell me, tell Dr. Eve, tell our sisters that are listening, and our brothers too, because the end of the day, it's not about being in control over anybody. It's about power that's being able to meet on a level that both of those elements can work together, right? It's about us working together.
Absolutely. Until we recognize the cause, we can't affect the healing. We can't start the heal until we see what the cause is. We got to address what the cause of this deterioration, you know, before we can address, you know, any solutions to it.
Right.
And I can't put it in a nutshell and say what it is, that what one thing caused our fall.
No, not one thing. Just one thing that you think that as women of color, to help our men of color, just one thing that you, because you could only speak from your context and your experience. And so what is the one thing? It doesn't have to be the one thing. Just one thing that you think would be advantageous for me to know.
I feel you, and we're speaking in general. I understand. Simply understand what the cause is. Let's investigate what the cause is. The cause. Because we're living the effect. Let's figure out what the cause is, and then we can start to repair this.
Okay.
Do you have any inkling of what might, you know, we know about the slavery thing. Do you have any other inkling that we might, that might cause the problem? Because I mean, not only does the black man have a problem, I mean, we too as women, I would say, have a lot of problem for the residual problem of slavery. However, I do think that women are we are trying in our unholiness and in our
lame body, we're still trying to hold this together. There is a woman right now with five children that is left to care for those five children. Some of them men are on the street, man-child that she cannot handle, that is going to fall prey to the Babylon system, that she is going to have to tie her belly and weep for those child going down in the earth prematurely. I mean, the man-child that we have in our society, the woman still who have a couple of the men-child there, does not have a good example unless there's a miracle in school that he has a particular maybe aptitude for either education or sports, and somebody might grab him and save him. Other than that, the street is going to be eating him raw. The home setting is totally deteriorated. And the woman, I care for a man child by myself, totally by myself. I must say, good evening to you, Sergeant Walker, over there in Italy, serving our country. Oh, I mean, I had to use, I knew exactly what was this, and I had to vacillate between being a woman and a man, and I fall in between the both. I am really hardcore woman. I really don't take any mess from anybody because I had to develop that.
That's right.
You understand? Pardon me?
If I can interject, I mean, that's naturally in you, just that strength is encoded in you. See, here's my thing. It's like we need to empty out our tainted cups in order to be refilled with something new. As far as examples, and I go back to learning our past, who we are, that's the key. Once we learn who we are, that will solve all the problems that we have today.
How do you think this show, because that's a very good thing there, this show is for healing. This show is for getting our brothers together and for me finding a man that I can really love upon big time, because I want some good loving. I'm going to put
that's
that
exactly
out there.
Right.
And just as hard as I am, I will love as hard as possible. So
nice.
What is it that we can do here? What kind of a program we can bring here, brother? That we can bring some more experts here. What kind of topics that we can talk about to help us, so we can come together at this table, so we can prepare the men to really love us like crazy, and we love them back. Tell us one thing that we can do here.
Find the template. We were that. How you speak, we were set. We were like that before. We just lost the template. We just need to get the template back and study it, and we're back in the game.
Mm-hmm.
As a people.
And I think part of that template is absolutely right, brother. I think a lot of that template has to do with communication. I know for me, when you talk, that's my passion. For me, everything has a pathway. And when you say go back and learn where you come from, that to me is power, because if you don't know where you're coming from, you don't understand the power from which you came, you don't understand the strength from which you come from, you don't understand the beauty from which you come from, and you are only engaging people who are showing you the negativity, and you're showing you the things that are bad, or the things that they define as bad, then you are only going to use their template because you don't have the reference.
Right.
You know, you don't have that, and that is important. And I agree 150% on that. That if I don't know where I come from, if I don't know the strength from which I come from, I will not be able to give my husband what he needs. I will not be able to give my best friend what he needs to support him. But the same flip side of that, if he doesn't know where he comes from, if he doesn't know the power and the strength from which he comes from, he will not know how to love me either.
You can never be whole.
And you can never be whole. So the teaching and the lesson for what you're saying, it comes from you have to, as an individual, find for yourself that which encourages you, what draws you, and inspires you to fuel that passionate desire and go back and to learn. Because I can't come, everything that I talk about, whether it's I'm passionate about it or whether I'm not, it's because I've engaged it in my life in one way, shape, or form. It's because I've opened myself to that teaching in one way, shape, or form. And it was not until I recognized at a very deep level when I came into the United States that I didn't just come from, you know, African people. I didn't come from slavery. I didn't come from none of it, all the negativity. But I came from Marcus Garvey. I came from Sister Nanny. I came from warriors that not only cleared a pathway for themselves and for their community, but deposited that same thing in me as a woman. Now that's given me the power that I need to go and create the same. I am Sister Nanny, one of our seven national heroes. Read upon the history of this woman and what she was able to do. As a woman from Jamaica, you will never, from the Caribbean, from Africa, you will never, if you recognize what she did as a woman, the British and the Spaniards had to sign a treaty because this strategist, this warrior, created such a fort, a fighting force. Because they came from power, they came from dignity, and they were like, we are not going into, what? I'm not a slave. So if we knew, and so that's what you're saying, if you know your history, my children are the direct descendants of Marcus Garvey, who inspired the civil rights movement here in the United States of America. Malcolm X, MLK. That's just part of our own national history, personal history, cultural history, but also African history. So when I speak on, I know who I am. I know the strength from which I come from. I know the power that I bring to a community, to a conversation. I know it. I walk into the room, not because I'm arrogant, not because I think I know everything. It's because I know who I am. And until we get to that place as women in communities, it's not to put a brother down. I love the fact that you called in, brother, and engaged this conversation. To me, that's love. I interpret that as love.
Yes.
Because you took the time to do that. You took the mental energy to formulate that thinking and say, you know what, I'm going to add something to that sister's conversation. Maybe she understands or maybe she doesn't, but I'm going to put it out there. To me, that's love. Now, if you would have thought
not to cut you off, but that's the creator. You know, that's the creator moving me, you know.
Thank you for that. I really appreciate that. You know, we got another call coming in. I want to lift you up for that because that to me is what love is. Not passively accepting, but intellectually, spiritually, and emotionally engaging something, even if there may be conflict, even if there may be, you know, a disagreement. I appreciate that, and I hope you call back in again because I would love to hear from you. And I hope you hit us up on Facebook and connect because I would love to keep you a part of the conversation if you don't mind.
Absolutely. I'm all plugged in, so you guys got me from now on.
What's your name? Let me get your name again if you don't mind.
Keith.
Your last name?
Clizark. Yes, Clizark. I'm in the chat room, so you can catch me there, too.
Oh, wonderful, Keith. Thank you. God bless you. Let's go ahead and get this other call. Big up to Keith for that.
All right, peace.
Peace out.
Peace out.
Blessings and good evening.
Good evening.
Welcome.
Good evening. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, good evening.
Good evening. Blessings.
Good evening.
Yeah, I am happy. I had to get out of the chat room to have a word with you because I have a couple of questions that I would like to ask you, Ms. Camille. Now, I hear you keep on talking about this creator and protector, redeemer, and stuff like that. And I want to ask you, in the years or the time of your life, because based on what you say, you were pretty innocent and could not defend yourself. Now, were you going to church at that time?
No, I was not in the church. I was I didn't have anybody to take me to church. I didn't get heavily involved in the church until I was struggling with depression and I was looking for some help somewhere, and the church was an option at the time, and I became very heavily involved in the church in my mid-20s.
Okay, so you think that you had to be going to church for the Lord to help you in that state?
Did I think that you mean in my mid-20s when I was in depression?
No, I am talking about when you were young and helpless, and as you described, you didn't know what these people were even doing to you. You weren't, you know, mature enough,
and they were
abusing you. So,
right.
So I'm asking you, in that state, you don't believe that God should have helped you at that time?
At that time, what I learned about the Creator and God and the divine, I didn't learn it in a Christian sense, Apple Pie. I learned it in sense of God is good. God is a lover. God is a protector, a creator. And so when all that stuff happened and I was in the United States and I was introduced to, you know, religion and Christianity, I didn't connect that the God that I believed in as loving and caring somehow allowed, you know, I didn't connect it. At the time, I didn't connect it. I was a little girl. That was not even, like, something I thought about. Now, years later, as I became an adult, I went through about 5 years where I was, like, I was cussing God out. I had a problem because the God that I was being taught about now was in an adult in the church, I was like, hold up. Now, you're saying that this God that, because as a child, I knew about God, but I didn't understand the dynamic. You understand what I'm saying?
But what I'm asking you, I mean, God is the creator, if we are understanding it right, what the Bible is telling us. And when you were in the womb, I mean, wasn't it his responsibility to protect you in the womb and when you come out the womb and when you are helpless?
I mean, is that how you interpret God? Because that's not how I necessarily interpret it now. If you're asking me now what I think, I'm going to tell you something different than what I thought back then.
All right. But simply what I'm trying to say, if our Creator has mm-hmm. nothing to do with us when we are oblivious to where He is or that He is, if He's not protecting and helping us, then why do we think when we become conscious it is us that need to recognize Him before He help us?
I'm not sure if I understand your question, but I understand the point you're making.
All right, well, let me repeat, because I want it to be abundantly clear. I mean, society is very screwed up with interpretation of Bible or whether Bible is really telling us right things. So what I am asking you is, the Creator is not one that anybody can hinder Him from doing what He wants. So I am saying, as you are there in the womb and out of the womb, helpless, I am asking you, isn't He responsible to protect you?
You're asking me now, is God responsible to protect me now?
Yeah, God is not capable of protecting you when you're unable at any time you're unable.
Well, let me ask you this, Apple Pie. Is that the way you see God?
Well, I mean, the way the Bible tells us.
Let me push back on you then, if you will allow me, because you're asking some big questions, and I want to push back on and ask you this. Well, how are you interpreting God? Are you interpreting God because of you? Did you grow up in the church?
Well, to answer you the right way, I interpret the Bible based on the...
No, you're answering a different question.
Etymology. But it's based on etymology. We cannot go away from words. We got to interpret the Bible by words, right? Right now.
No. The Bible, you're answering about the Bible. I'm asking you about God. different.
But the Bible teaches me about God. The Bible teaches me about God.
Now, so that's the distinction I'm trying to make with you right now. You have learned to define God by the Bible.
Yes.
Not a problem with that. I don't have a problem with that.
What's your problem?
I don't have a problem with that at all. I have
all right.
learned, and my point is that the God that I think about now and I talk to and I'm is not defined by these words, is defined by life itself, by creation, by the process, by my engagement with you, by other human beings. God, for me, is bigger than the biblical text, which is only one religious text amongst thousands of other religions, right?
Where is that text that you're referring to?
There's you got the Quran, you got the Hebrew text, you got the text, I mean, from the Shintos, you got thousands of biblical texts, Bible texts.
So which one is the right one?
Do you think there's a right one?
Well, you know, doctor, if we're going to talk about God, we've got to get him from someone of these sources, right?
Yeah, but you're telling me, you want me to define the God that you are talking about.
Doc, I want you to tell me about the God that you found on this
source. I'm telling you that the God that I worship and know is beyond the biblical Christian text.
But how did you first find him? How did you first find him?
I don't know. I mean, when I was a young
Lord,
girl, my grandmother. I mean, what are you asking
come on.
Me?
Doc, listen. All right. Let's get off that.
Let's say one thing here. We have just about 30 minutes. We have
I'm trying
a show
to get to what
Monday.
Apple Pie is trying
let's,
to say. I love this conversation. Please. I love it. I love it.
Listen, we got 30 minutes to go. Our Monday show, we're going to be engaging in that because this is more befitting. We want to focus a little bit more on trying to focus on some of the hurt, which I know ties into the Bible. But can we just save this a little bit for Monday?
Yes, because I have a question about the man thing. I think that you're getting the man thing pretty much wrong. And you see, we're not going to solve the rape and the abuse problems because I think based on what we know about man, and I am a man, you see, look, do you know that the reason why a man turns is when you see a man, a woman and a man pass each other on the road, a nice-looking woman, nice dress and everything. When both of them pass each other, look and see which one always turns the head and look behind them to see the other one. It's usually the man who looks around and turn to see the woman, all right? So we got to address this thing from the hormonal problem. Now, it's a secretion.
Well, you know what? You know, you're going to push back real hard on that because the hormonal... You're talking about rape and hormones?
Yes.
This is a whole nother conversation, Apple Pie. This is like a whole... We need to have this conversation face-to-face. I mean,
Let me tell you one thing that I think...
Hormones and rape have nothing to do with it.
All right. Then let me tell you one thing. Let me tell you one thing about a man. You know, a man would not even look on a woman no more than he looks at a tree if he did not have those libidinal hormones. He would not. So if you don't understand that, he would just hate you no more than a woman hates you. Okay? So you better get that straight. It's what we are perceiving.
What I better do is respect the way you feel that you think, and I do.
But it's the problem that you face, the very problem that you face why a man abuses you. It's not a woman that was doing it. It's a man.
Listen, first of all, you need to get something straight. Abuse mm-hmm. happened to a child. I didn't make it happen, nor did any other child make abuse happen.
I'm not
the language
that.
You're using is very problematic to me right now, and I'm going to push back hard on you.
I'm not saying you caused it.
That's what I'm trying to say to you is be careful of how you say that because you're talking to women and children and people who have been abused to give them the impression that they caused it in any way, shape, or form, even if you didn't mean it.
But
you have to be careful of your language.
The man. I said the hormone of the man, if it wasn't in him, if it wasn't in the man,
what happens
the woman,
to a woman who is an abuser?
I'm not addressing a woman abuser. I'm addressing a man, a male abuser right now. And
outside, we have another phone call coming in. You got to make sure you keep in touch because I want to keep having this conversation with you.
All right,
and Monday, right, Doc? You're saying that we're doing this on Monday.
Monday.
Here's my last take on this.
All right.
Is that when a man hormonal level rises, his brain no longer functions very well. It is the penis head that functions well at that time. Okay?
All right. All right, now let's go ahead and get the other call.
All right.
Hello, good evening. Hello?
469, good evening. I think they're just listening, and once they don't have their hand up, they're just listening.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, that was a very interesting phone call. Papa, I love the conversation. We need to have this again. But you may not define Christianity.
Well, definitely, we certainly will. Love a Papa Pie. And this is what the conversation is all about. For people to really empty, you cannot, as Keith said, you cannot get forward if you don't know yourself. And no matter how it sounds, we need to get it out on the open, and then we can start to examine and take out what needs to be taken out, mend what needs to be taken to be mended and throw away what needs to be thrown away, and we form another way that we're going to look at life until something better comes. You know, this is the better come. I wanted to talk a little bit about what this Help the Woman Cry is trying to foster, or we're trying to do. I know that we talked about, tell us a little bit about how this all gets started, what we intend to do, some of the stuff that are in the pipeline. We just have about 20 minutes left.
You know,
so,
that's so amazing you said that, because I think you're right. I was trying to send you a little private message earlier before we start the show to say, let's talk a little bit about a lot of the things that are coming up. I mean, I know when we initially talked about this, we really wanted to have a place for women to cry, but the crying is as physical as it is symbolic. It's about a place where women could develop relationships, communication, an open space where we can become sisters. We can become mothers to each other, sisters to each other, friends to each other, and use that collective energy, use that collective force to again, help other sisters cry, help other sisters weep, help other sisters laugh. Build this kind of global force of women loving on each other, supporting each other, but also exposing injustice that has been perpetuated against each other. It's not about bashing anybody. It's not about putting anyone down. It's really about women taking their voice and using it in a way that inspires them as well as inspires other women. It's really about releasing that story that's been placed in the woman, in her womb, in her belly, because of systematic, because of, the pain, because of abuse. That's the issue. And so I know
this is the framework that we're going to be trying to involve women into getting us to get together, getting us to start a dialogue. And part of that, we start over on Facebook. For those of you who are in the chat who doesn't know the room, it is Help the Woman Cry on Facebook. Maybe we could put that down there. And there's a lot of conversation that goes on. So we take this conversation live on a Sunday night, 8 to 11. Some of the things that we talked about, We're trying to get together as part of the movement, and I know you're strong about going back to Jamaica, reaching for some of these women in the rural area and connecting with them and helping them to cry, basically, absolutely listening to their story, whatever their abuse is, and even their social situation because of the different plights. Of poverty, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and bring some warmth and comfort and maybe help them in some way to realize some of their dreams. Tell us about some of the programs that is in the works and how we can reach out and, work along with you.
Well, right now, we're on Facebook, and hit us up on Facebook. We're also doing some things with, and we've talked a lot about this, but creating like a poetry book with the ladies. We got the Facebook page going on, and we have a lot of women who have a lot of things that they're trying to say and want to say and that they do say. And so maybe after some time we can kind of create a compilation of these words, of these women's tears, of these women's joys, and put it in a book and kind of put it out there and raise some issues, some funds for some of the things that we got going on with the women, and maybe even at some point in time go back to Jamaica and use some of the funds that we've created. And I think we talked recently, too, about possibly putting together a little cookbook, which was, I think, you're a brilliant idea. Again, bringing awareness, helping the women to connect, helping the women to kind of collectively contribute something and raise funds to go back and take it back to these communities and help more women. But I know one thing that you are extremely excited about, Dr. Eve, and I want you to talk about that a little bit, is the ideas of the drums and creating a movement, behind the drums and creating some conversations with using the drums and putting on some concerts and, connecting with some organizations the potential of this is so large and so wide. Every time I think about it, I get extremely excited. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about the drums?
Oh, absolutely. I'll be happy. You get me smiling there for a while. the drum, which started a drum revolution, and that came out of a conversation. I had this idea about 2 years ago. At that point in time, we were thinking about equipping all women, where we had all of this turmoil going on. And I just so believe in the power of women. At that time, I thought if we equip women with drum and synchronize that for peace all over the world, then we will begin to start to have people, our men counterpart and whoever else that is fostering war, would at least start to listen because of the power of the drums. So anyway, in talking to Mr. Coffey a couple of weeks ago, and he started to tell me about his mom and how his mom really reached out in although she had extreme poverty, reached out and bought every instrument that she could put her money on for him. Hence, we have one great drummer and musician. For those people who are listening, this young man, he does the theme song for Cops. Bad boys, what you gonna do?
What's
he gonna do? What's he gonna do? So he was on my interview last week, and we'll be having him helping us a lot. And I decided immediately to honor his mom for her effort and name the movement after her. So it's Miss Frances Coffey. Miss Frances May Coffey Drum Revolution. That's
nice.
What we centered on now. Here is how this is going to happen. We, for those of us who are listening, who understand the power of the drums. The drum is the heartbeat. It is the centering for me. It is the centering. It is the drum that we used when, if you were read about slavery, it is that point of communication. It's that point of healing. It's that point that gave those who are under stress and strain and pressure and lifeless, that was what gave hope. I do feel when you start to hit the drums, depends on how you can evoke different kind of life through the drum within you. And this is why I think this is so important. We plan to get a drum to every person, a young child. We're going to start from the root, from the basic school. So we're starting from 3 to 7 in the basic school. That's it. So if we try to get a drum in every basic school, we want to do it at least by the middle of 2013. Hopefully we can get it done by the end of the year. Once we get that going, we're going to be having a drum festival in Jamaica somewhere. We have not looked at the location as yet. And this could be a 2 or 3 day festival. It could be a 1 day festival as well. When all of the kids would be, by now we would have given them time to learn to play the drums. So far, we have about 20 or so musicians who have come forward to say they are in. And that kind of blows my mind. I am not surprised, but it blows my mind at the speed and the energy they've brought to this project. So we hope to do a lot of things, maybe put out a CD with some of these musicians that would be able to help bringing more funds quickly.
And I know one of the things that we talked about as well, that all of this is just, you know, coming into play. So listen out and look out, people, because we're about to do it insanely crazy, meaning we're just going to take this movement, this action global in such a way that you ain't going to have no other choice but to pay attention. But one of the things that I know that I'll be doing with the nonprofit that we're working on is literally creating like video dramas, video documentaries on women's lives. And my hope and my goal is to go to Jamaica to get some stories from the women there, go to Europe, just go where women are, go where women are ready to tell their stories, go where women are ready to change the conversation about what they are able to do in their lives, how they're able to empower themselves in their communities. And so, I mean, there's just so many things in the pipeline that it's, you know, it's exciting, it's amazing, and we need to hear from the community, we need to hear from the women. You know, hit us up on Facebook.
I mean, definitely, that's who we really need to hear from, because the strength and the grassroots power is very important. It's usually coming from the women. Of course, my brothers, I mean, there's some wonderful brothers that are very, very supportive to a lot of the programs that we started, and I thank you so, so much. Here is what also, when we do the drum festival, we're going to be trying to, I don't know if there's a record yet, at the same time, to get more attention to the program, get the biggest try to go for the Guinness Book of Records.
We're gonna create an army of drummers all over the world and break the Guinness Book of World Records. It's a drum revolution, man.
To get the biggest drum circle in the world in Jamaica. Here is how we're going to do the drum as well. The drums are going to be sponsored by you, somebody out there, you. And I hope that you will be able to sponsor. On the drum, it's going to have the sponsor's name as well as the child's name, and along with an inspiration message, a line or two. That child is going to grow into the drum. This child is going to have a relationship with this drum and this beat. We are going to have a page a website. So if any one of you bright folks out there who is able to create a site, something in the form of F-Book, that's what we're looking at. The drums are going to be the profile picture. Every single drum would be numbered, and the profile picture with the drum. So the drum is going to have a life. So whoever has the drum is going to write the life with that drum and themselves. Of course, those drums are going to meet other drums, and they're going to have playoffs, and they're going to have friends, and just about everything. So the drum, every single drum would be accounted for.
Nice.
When we do 100,000, 200,000, it is going to be numbered up to there. And every single drum is going to have a face on this website with the owner.
Wonderful.
I know by the time we get that done, then this is going to escalate into people getting a drum because of this, because they want to be involved.
I was saying, Dr. Eve, you know what's really good is to also, like you said, we need to reach out to folks who want to be a part of this that can help and contribute, because we're looking for sponsors. We're looking for people who are interested in being a part of the conversation. And the drums, if I'm incorrect, please correct me, but the part of it is to raise funds for schools, for primary schools in Jamaica, right?
We're going to do it to the basic schools, and we equip them
basic
first
schools,
and then move on up to the other schools. By then, we would hope that we wouldn't probably necessarily have to buy everybody a drum, but people would start getting drum because they want to be a part of this.
Nice, and that's so all of those musicians, you know, everybody out there, corporations who want to sponsor something, who want to be a part of the education, because this is an educational initiative. At the end of the day, that's what this is. But it's also a movement to inspire, you know, kind of a global volunteerism, a kind of local volunteerism where we are connected with one cause, we're connected with creating a conversation and a message about something that's bigger than ourselves. So if you're interested, if you want to be a part of this and you're a corporation and you are an individual, you're anybody who wants to contribute in any way, shape, or form, hit us up on Facebook, hit us up on the Caribbean Radio Show, call us in, just let us know that you want to engage this, because at the end of the day, this is about raising money to help the schools. This is about helping the children. This is about changing their future. This is about giving them options and opportunities so that they can become the leaders, the mothers, the fathers, the parents, really, the community leaders, the political leaders that we need for our communities. We need in our homes. We need in our societies. So it's a small attempt. It's on your part when you call us, you get involved. But it's going to be attached to something so much larger, so much bigger, and it's for something great.
And envisioning all of this, can you imagine drum number two, who is living next door to drum number 10 or whatever it is, come out and these three little 6-year will come on and say, hey, I just found me a new beat on the drum. And the drum number two say, hey, let me hear it. I'm day, whatever. The other one say, okay, man, come on. You're beat soft, man. Listen to this one.
Nice.
So whatever it is, the sound that they make. And rather than kids pulling out their weapon and say, hey, we have a big old iron bigger than yours, man. I'm going to blow your head off. We will have kids competing on the drum in a friendly way. Can you imagine
so
the
beautiful
beauty this will be?
That is so beautiful. It really evokes a really awesome image in my head, especially since, I don't know if you've heard of it, but over the last couple of weeks there has been this kind of viral response to a video that was put out, Dr. Eve, on this gentleman called Corey in, I think he was in either Uganda, where he is really creating child soldiers. He's not using drums. He's using weapons, and he's placing them into children's hands. So just to kind of create a different message with that, with the drums, the kind of contrast between handing a child a gun versus handing a child a musical instrument, a drum, so that they can create their own beat, so they can create their own music, create their own stories, and inspire other children, connect with other children. That is very beautiful.
I can even
see us putting a video together, Dr. Eve, and putting it on YouTube, like a video of this movement, of what it could do and what it could be, and just send it out there and get a viral response the same way that this other video response, this other video got.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And this is why we need some of these creative forces.
Right.
On Facebook, who are very young men and women,
and you know,
I don't want to say I'm pleading. You know, you want to think that this is something that everybody would say, I'm in, and then call your friends and tell them I'm in. I am going to be part of something bigger than me for the revolution, drum revolution in itself. Dancing, because anywhere you have drum, you have dancing. And rather we dance to peace and beat to the heartbeat of a drum, which would evoke peace. I mean, we should have everybody, in my mind, everybody should be jumping,
right.
This is something that we could at least try to see if we can get a better world together. One way or the other. You know what I'm saying?
I definitely understand that.
It is something that I, you know, our brother Keith says, what can we do? We're constantly here, myself and Sister Camille, trying to find the ways that we can make some love to the world without without feeling that we are in danger. I want to get to, you know, protect our child. We want to have our child run free in whatever park they can.
Yes.
I mean, free, that if a stranger comes to them, you know, this is not something that your heart goes out of your beat and your weapons comes out or so, because here is somebody who is aiming to hurt your children. I am not saying that we're going to be getting rid of all things non-human, although we're going to try our best. If we'll achieve it, no, but we want to leave a legacy. So I'm saying, at least we tried. We did not sit back. If there is a creator that sent us to do a mission, to be loving and caring, you know what? We are going to be getting a nice little tick beside our name. Other things, I don't know.
Exactly.
Other things I don't know, but at least I am going to try something to help my brother man in order to make this experience here a little bit better for us.
And
if we start that, we can be on our way. Maybe along the way, we will find the answer.
And that's the idea, that the conversation that we began here, helping women to share their stories, to share their tears, has a much broader implication than just, you know, getting women to call in and talk about the pain that happened to them. That's a part of this journey. That's a part of this conversation. But as we're talking now, we're talking about creating a global movement around an educational initiative by using drums, by using music. That's part of what we do as women. That's who we are as women. We are innovators. We are creators. We see a problem and we find a solution and we get it together and we get it done. But we no longer have to do that burdening ourselves with the pain of our past, the pain of somebody else's problem because they saw us as, you know, as are enticed by us as little girls or whatever because we were raped. No, the story is so much broader than what someone did to us. The story is so much broader than what the pain that we carry. That's a part of it. And it's a very important part, because unless, like the brother Keith that called in, unless we're able to recognize our past and find some type of closure and some type of understanding about that, it's very difficult to move into our future. And this is, as women, this is who we are. We are innovators naturally. We are influencers naturally. When we speak about something with passion and intention, people listen. When we put our whole selves into a cause, into a movement, and because we're trying to inspire change, and we're trying to inspire change in education, people pay attention. So, Dr. E, this is the story that I'm saying to you. The listeners are listening. This is happening because we are speaking it. God gave us this, and it's, we're putting it out there, and there is going to be this response that's going to get this done, period, because this is who we are.
Absolutely. I want to thank Caribbean Lady. She just joined the site as well, and I'm encouraging everybody here. We have about 12 of us here. That means it will be 12 more people get counted. And this is what I'm talking about. We always think that, you know, when it comes on to help and being a part of something, we always think that, the other person can take up this slack. It's not me. It's not for me. Somebody else would do it. And I'm saying to everybody listening to me, we need your help. With or without your help, it will happen. If it's even one child, we are going to give a drum. If it isn't one, I'm sure that there's not going to be one child. Because that one child that you helped to get a drum would be one child that probably the drum will take them out of poverty. Probably instead of taking up a gun, they will take up the drum itself. Probably that one child will make you feel safer. So this is what I'm saying to my people. I think we as black folks, let me just kind of generalize, because you talk to your own people first, and then you spread out, pass on Chris and his children first. Why are we at the stage that we have to beg each other, to participate and do something with us? We complain, we're not getting this, this is not done. And yet still, when a sister or a brother have a movement that could help us in the long run, we hesitate. We take our own time. We are not the people who get down in the gutter and pull up our sleeve and say, hey, you know what? At least let me try this. At least let me stand beside the sister or the brother. It is so difficult for us to get us together to do anything.
Yes.
And I don't know if this is a part of our slave. We blame everything on slave. All right, okay. If we blame anything on slavery, come on, it's time we cut that out.
Right.
We're trying to get rid of the slavery thing now. We're trying to not use that. You're listening to my voice. We have 12 people here, at least I'm seeing 12 people. There are a lot of other people listening to the other stuff. Call one person, and here's the deal. If you have a special family member that you want to honor, honor them with placing the gift of a drum to a young child in the Caribbean.
Yes, and that's the end of it, is that we now have to put our money and our actions and our resources to where our mouth is. We believe in helping kids, we believe in the education initiative, we believe in helping women, then we now need to act upon it. And that's what my sister is saying, Dr. Eve. And that's what we're saying here every Sunday from 8 to 11. Get connected, reach out, hit us up on Facebook. I'm on Twitter. More things are coming. So don't sleep, don't fall asleep on what's going on. Become part of the movement, become part of what's going on. And pay attention to what's happening.
For those people out there, be the first. We should be wrestling to get drum number one.
You know, that's what I'm talking about.
Nice.
Because, you know, jump number one is going to be a very, very important drum. So be wrestling to get drum number one. That's what we're talking about.
And just like you said, you know, you can get a drum and donate it to a school, to a church. You can do it in the honor of somebody's name that you love. You can do it in honor of your child, your grandmother. You can. There's so many ways that you can help what the cause that we're doing, but also bless somebody in your own life. Do something for someone that you love. So, get the drum. Be the first to do this. Be the first to be a part, because no one else is doing this. This is something new and hot here at Caribbean Radio Show.
Yes.
So get involved and be a part of it.
Yeah, be a foot soldier. Join us. We need so much. We need so much help. Please join us. Please, if we're doing anything that you have a bigger and better idea, I mean, bring it to the table. Let's be the one to start something. Let's be the one to start a trend. And we're talking about the drum trend here. Come on. Let's be the one to make, you know, somebody listening to me can have, say, hey, sister, we want to go to Jamaica and make this presentation myself to a child that is going to be a name that is drawn out of this box. But I'm going to go and make this donation of a drum to this child myself. And here is the wonderful thing. You make a donation to Peter Johnson, make a donation to drum number one, who is a little sweet, beautiful girl. If you look on the website, you would see the most beautiful sight you will ever see in your life. A young, beautiful girl in her natural state, beautiful African hair twisted up, hitting a kettle drum. Oh, my God, if that don't move you, then I don't know what will. But see yourself giving this little baby here the first drum. I am sure that there is going to be a connection between both of you. If you have friends in your, if you have kids in your family, then number one drum, which is Mary Jane, would be almost become a part of your family. So that family, inducted in the drum revolution, come on. You cannot afford not to be like that, to be a part of this. Trust
Absolutely.
Me, get in from the bottom floor, because
get
this
in from
is
it
just
right
going to be
Absolutely
just
right.
so joy.
It's going to blow up. It's going to take off because it's positive. It's for a positive cause. It's also something that you can be a part of yourself. It doesn't require you to have a whole lot of money, do a whole lot of things. It's just a simple gesture, a simple act of giving back. That's going to have a much larger, greater ripple effect, not just in, you know, you reaching out to other people and showing love to other people and those kids, but to literally helping schools, you know, raise money and raise funds for their educational resources. So it's all well. Everything about it is powerful and positive. And just reach out, connect, do it. Be the first, you know, to do it, because no one is doing this anywhere. This is, and especially coming from the Caribbean, Dr. Eve is a genius, because this is something that is not only needed, it's not only needed, but it's something that can actually create a conversation so much larger than what it is.
Yes.
You know, so get in on it, man. We don't even have to say no more. I know you're going to do it. I know you're going to be a part of it, because we are people who take action. We are women of action, and that's who we are. That's what we do. You know, we are quick to take care of others. We're quick to take care of our children, our husbands, our spouses, our friends, our, you know, our church, everything. Now we're doing something that's going to help us to connect to a deeper part of ourselves, other women. This is who we are with Dr. Eve, with Sister Camille. We're out here putting it out on every Saturday, every Sunday night from 8 to 11, and even on Wednesdays from 8 to 11, because we would love to hear from you. We want to hear from you. And this drum cause, this drum movement, is only one of the amazing initiatives that we're doing. Just pay attention and look out on Facebook, on Twitter. A blog is coming up soon. We're going to be doing video documentaries. I'm going to be following amazing women, putting their stories out there. Dr. Eve, you're going to be my first, so be ready. I'm coming where you are with the video, with the camera, and you're going to tell it like it is. You're going to show us how it's done, because you're going to be the first one. If I didn't tell you, I'm telling you now.
Oh, you're making me have a goosebumps. You go to my goosebumps place.
Well, I'm going to tell you, you're going to be the first one out there. We need to see our strong women, not just hear from them. We want to see them. And so you're going to be the first. So big up to Dr. E. She's the first. Now you be the first and get a drum.
Yes, 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 yes. And I also propose those ladies who are bringing this wonderful life to extend life here, ask requests if you can that a drum be part of your shower, so the child would be greeted first by the drum. So ladies who have showers coming up, please make sure one of your gifts is a drum for that life coming forth.
Well, that's an amazing idea. That's an amazing idea.
Yes.
See how creative, how many ways that we can think about not just blessing our someone that we know personally, but we also doing something that's going to have a greater impact in the community. I mean, how amazing is that?
Yeah.
And you will be the first. And women, I mean, we out there, we need to tell our sisters, tell our family, tell our communities, talk to the kids in the school, wherever you work, whatever you're doing, spread the message of what we're trying to do, what we're trying to evoke. We may not get it right all the time, but our intention is to do the right thing by not just ourselves as women, but by other women out there that are trying to do the right thing, that are trying to take care of their families, that are trying to create an impact in their world. This is who we are. This is what we're trying to do. We are Renaissance women, man, and we're trying to draw you into this cause because there's some big things getting ready to happen.
Absolutely, my darling. Embrace and love you long time, sister.
Love you long time. Big love to you. Big love to the Caribbean Radio Show. Big love to the bloggers out there. Big love to them on Facebook, Apple Pie. I love you. Mr. Keith that called in, love that. I'm looking forward to talking to you again. Absolutely. And, of course, Dr. Eve, you know me. Love you. Long, long, long time.
Love you long time, my sister. Peace out. Thank you.
All right.
Ciao.